You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast, Lead Singer Syndrome. I'm your host, Shane Told. Just like every single week for 253 episodes, I believe we're at. That's a wild number. Thanks so much for all the love, all the support. We got a great guest, a great program today for you. Dallin Weeks of I Don't Know How, But They Found Me, he's here. You might also know him from his nearly decade-long stint in Panic at the Disco. He was also in an awesome band back in the day called the Brobecks. This guy is legit. This guy is well-spoken. And don't sleep on this new I Don't Know How, But They Found Me album as well. Their debut full length, surprisingly, I feel like this band has been around for so long, but this is their first album, and it bangs. It kills. And it's out now, so check it out. It's a great conversation. I can't wait for you to hear it. But before we get into that, a few things to take care of. I want to remind you that you can get in touch with me if you've got suggestions for the show or anything else you want to say to me. You can email me. It is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com, and I read all my emails. I've been so busy lately. I guess it's just because I've said yes to everything. You know, I think when the pandemic hit in mid-March and, you know, forced to go home, there was this fear of there being nothing to do. And I just started saying yes to everything, and I've continued through to that, and now I find myself almost, geez, what has it been, 9 months? My God. I find myself very busy. So I'm keeping on, but I do have a chance to read all my emails. So send me one, add me to social media, but the thing I want you to do most, actually, the thing I want you to do second most is add my Twitch channel, which is twitch.tv/ShaneTold, and I'm going live on there all the time. Mike Howell of This Is The New Shit. We're doing episodes basically every week talking about the new records coming out, and you don't want to miss the episodes we have coming out as well, because there are going to be some cool end of the year episodes, which of course you can still listen to them here. But if you want to get the live vibe, if you want to actually see video of us talking about it, and, you know, we interact with the chat and all that as well, head over to Twitch, twitch.tv/ShaneTold, and I'm on there playing acoustic some days and all kinds of stuff. It's a great platform, not just for video games. So yes, add me. I'll say the link one more time, twitch.tv/ShaneTold. But the number one thing I want you to check out, of course, is the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. Could be the gift that keeps on giving for somebody you know that likes the podcast or likes music or whatever. Head over to leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess for all that information. And for as little as $6 a month, it gets you in. It helps support this show. Keep it going every week for free. And there's a whole bunch of perks like bonus episodes and access to a great club and merchandise and everything else. So there it is, the All Access Club. Don't miss that either. Well, I'll keep the intro short, and this is a pretty short episode, actually. But, you know, we're all busy. We got things to do. We got Christmas shopping. So if you're done this one and you want more, go back and listen to one of the other 250-something episodes. And if you've listened to them all, join the All Access Club. There's more there. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. Here's my conversation with Dallin Weeks of I Don't Know How, But They Found Me. I'm here with Dallin Weeks.
Hello.
Dude, hello. Yes, thank you for doing this. Great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to do it.
Yeah, lots to talk about. I don't even know where to start, but I guess we should start with the new record. Just came out. Long awaited.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Long awaited by us, for sure.
Right. I feel like you guys have been around for a while. You know, like I remember... you know, friends of mine and stuff, touring with you guys and hearing about the band and kind of watching you grow. And we do a separate bit of the podcast where we talk about the new albums coming out. And your album was the number one, you know, record of the week.
Oh, wow.
And I was absolutely shocked that it was your first album. I just, you know, couldn't believe it that after all these years, finally we have an album and it's a good one.
Well, yeah, it was a weird time frame. You know, definitely not traditional trajectory for bands that are starting out. Like the first year or so that we did this band, it was all in secret because Ryan and I were both still employed in other bands at the time, and we didn't want to exploit that fact or exploit those fans or anything or capitalize on that. So we did secret shows for about a year and had all these songs and our own timeline in mind for releasing this record. But as momentum sort of started to build faster than we could catch up with it, Fearless Records stepped in and we ended up touring for a while off of a 5-song EP that was supposed to be part of this record. So really we've been sitting on a lot of these songs for a while, but recording the album properly got put on hold in favor of building the band up a little bit more and touring for a while.
Right.
So that's been the challenge for us is having all this extra material that we've just been waiting to get recorded and released into the world. So we finally got to do that. So it feels really good to finally be there.
Right, for sure. I mean, what is traditional anymore, though? I mean, no bands seem to do, you know, the traditional method, you know, is completely dead. When younger bands ask me, like, hey, I'm starting a band, like, What do I do? At this point, I'm like, I don't know, fucking TikTok? Like, I don't know what a band does anymore when they're starting out.
Exactly. There's no playbook anymore.
Right.
So it's all kind of everybody grabbing at straws, and hopefully, you know, if you keep working and you don't give up, you'll have that lightning strike for you, that little piece of luck that everybody needs to have happen.
That's right. And it seems like you've finally gotten it with this band. I know, you know, your first band, the band that you put, you know, so much of your time and life into was the Brobecks.
Yeah.
Straight out of Utah. And, you know, a band that's very critically acclaimed. Something that, you know, people are still listening to on Spotify, like pretty decent, solid Spotify numbers on there too, you know? So, you know, talk to me about that band, you know, how you got your start off in this crazy world and I guess the humble beginnings of Dallin Weeks, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess it does really start with the Brobecks in my early 20s. That's sort of when I discovered that there was a very active and thriving music scene in my city here in Salt Lake City that I wasn't aware of when I was a teenager, but became aware in my early 20s and got started with the Brobecks. And that's the band that made me really solidify that, oh, well, I have to do music forever.
Nice.
Because it was the first real musical project I had where, you know, people came to see us play that weren't related to us, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what made me really make that decision. But like a lot of artists out there, we struggled and we sort of hit this plateau and, you know, found some regional success, but that next step never really came.
Right.
So that lightning that I was talking about, that lightning you got to catch, that little piece of luck, we never really had that. So we ended up, you know, going separate ways and being employed in other various positions. I ended up getting a job with Panic at the Disco, and I was really lucky to have that job for as long as I did.
For sure, for sure. I mean, I don't want to harp on that too long, but I mean, how do they find you? Pardon the pun.
Well, it was because of the Brobecks, really, because we did get a good handful of label offers back in the day, but mm-hmm. nothing that was worth taking, really. Especially for me, since I had a very new family at the time that I needed care of.
Right.
And some of these contracts that were being sent our way were essentially going to be making no money at all for years and years and years.
Yeah.
So, you know, these offers that we were taking, whether it was that or whether it was labels coming in saying, hey, you know, Dallin, we want to sign you, but you have to get your band. That also wasn't something I was willing to do. So, you know, those offers, they came and went. And but that's how we ended up on Panic's radar, because Fueled by Ramen, their label, was one of the labels that came knocking on the Brobeck storage and right. end up working out. But whenever Panic had a couple people that quit and they wanted to carry on, the head of their label reached out to me and said, hey, Panic is doing this tour. Do you want to come out and audition? So I did, and they ended up using me and kept using me for about a year before they asked me to join the band as a full-time member. And then I spent the next almost decade doing that.
Yeah. That first tour was with Blink-182, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, it was really strange to go from, you know, doing Brobecks where, you know, at the most, Brobecks sell out a 200-person room.
Yeah.
So to go from that to playing a 20,000-person arena over the course of, like, a week was definitely, you know, intimidating.
To be able I can't
to look
imagine.
Out into a crowd and,
right.
and the faces, they just keep going and going and going. So it was really intimidating and hard to get used to. I don't know if you ever really get used to that.
Right, right. No, but I mean, for you though, and reading about you and knowing a little bit about kind of your influences, I mean, it seems like you're more influenced by, you know, stuff that maybe people would call before your time. Like we're the same age. We're both born in 1981. So, you know, mm-hmm. for me, like Blink-182 was a big influence, you know, and the mm-hmm. pop punk and the Warped Tour stuff. I feel like even though you are somewhat, you know, associated with that, for you, your influences lie, you know, with the generation kind of before.
Yeah, it is bizarre to have that association simply by, you know, the jobs that I've had is kind of interesting because, yeah. You know, there's no denying that those genres and those kind of bands have had huge success and have been largely influential. But things like pop punk and emo music and really, really that whole Warped Tour scene, it's not anything that ever really touched my life or connected with me. So right. I kind of missed that whole movement. And, you know, when it was going on, I was listening to stuff like The Killers and Louis XIV and Franz Ferdinand and, you know, I'm a Robot, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that was my early 2000s when that whole, when the whole pop punk thing was going on. So I kind of missed that wave. So that's not something that ever really, influenced me. So it's odd somewhat to have an association to that world simply because I played in Panic at Disco for a number of years. I understand it
yeah.
because
yeah.
I feel like a lot of the same people make lowest common denominator connections. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a sort of human nature, you know, the straight line. And so people are able to go, oh, well, you played in this band. You must like kind of music. Well,
right.
that's not always necessarily true.
No, it's definitely not necessarily true. But I mean, your drummer, Ryan, shit, I've known Ryan for 15 years at least.
Yeah.
He definitely was inspired by those bands.
No, he absolutely was. He was. He's definitely got that stuff in his musical DNA.
Right on, man. So you say before your early 20s, when you kind of realized that there was a thriving scene in Salt Lake City, you know, you didn't know about it, but you were, I guess, practicing cutting your teeth as a teenager. You know, I know you were from a Mormon household, probably fairly strict about, you know, some rules. What was that like growing up for you, and how was music playing a role in that?
You know, it's not something that that I have a resentment towards. Like, I'm really grateful for my upbringing, and but when it came to music, it's not, you know, as rock music in particular, is not something that I was ever encouraged to. Like, I had that interest since I was about 3 years old. I remember driving past like a pawn shop window and seeing a guitar hanging there, and I telling mom and dad, I want that. I didn't even know what it was, but I know that I wanted it.
It will be mine. Oh yes, it will be mine.
Yeah, exactly. So over the years, they kind of indulged that in the way of, you know, Christmas time, they'd buy me like a toy guitar or something, and then I was thrilled to have it. But it wasn't until I was 15 where I was like, I've got to go get a real guitar. So I saved up all this money, went to a pawn shop and bought myself a guitar, like a real one. And they were so bummed that I had spent this money on this complete waste of time that would take me nowhere and ruin my life. So, wow. You know, because when I was a kid, you know, rock bands and, you know, rock musicians, there was that heavy cliche of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And
right.
The biggest bands at the time when I was a kid growing up are like these, you know, Sunset Strip hair metal stuff that I don't really like at all, like your Motley Crue's and your Guns N' Roses and that. So that's what they associated rock and roll music with. Like, if our son plays guitar, he's going to turn into one of these pieces of trash. But as I grew older, especially in the 90s, I became interested in a lot of artists that had this particular set of values or an ethos, really. When it came to making music, it was more about making art for the sake of making art rather than perpetuating some lifestyle of partying and drugs and things like that. Bands like you know, even bands that did have their problems, like Nirvana,
right.
You know, they weren't glorifying any kind of lifestyle. They just wanted to make music. Same with like Pearl Jam, or even some of the stuff that I was more into, like Weezer and Ben Folds 5. You know, these were bands that were making music for the sake of making music, not because they wanted to, you know, to spend their life partying.
Absolutely.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You start this thing with Ryan. It seems like at first nobody knew what was going on. You guys were denying everything. Mm-hmm. I still don't know if it's a genius marketing strategy or if you just honestly weren't sure what was going on, because you were still immersed with Panic. Ryan was still immersed with Falling in Reverse. You know, I mean, a lot of times, you know how musicians are. Hey, let's just play some tunes. Let's get together. There isn't always a lot of talk of like, okay, this is the master plan. And in 2020, this crazy shit's going to happen and we're going to put out our first album. You know, like no one saw this coming. So I just wonder the initial foresight that you may or may not have had, you know, when you guys kind of started out.
Well, that's the beauty of everything that's happened with us so far is that everything that we've done has sort of been born out of necessity. And spending that first year playing in secret or so, you know, we definitely didn't have an agenda. We just wanted to make music, be creative, and have fun playing music, because we were both in similar situations, doing a particular job, working with a band for so long that it had become just that, a job. And, you know, I find that, you know, it in the world of music, if if it becomes not fun anymore, then you need to change something, because that's what this is supposed to be about, first and foremost. So we got together to do this just to remember how to have fun again, playing music and not have it feel like we're punching a time card or something like that. And so playing in secret and denying everything wasn't so much a marketing ploy rather than a way of us to be able to do this under the radar just for ourselves, also without really bringing down the wrath of, you know, anybody that we were working for at the time. So it kind of just snowballed out of our control. And, you know, what a great problem to have, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the momentum started rolling faster than we could keep up with it. And eventually I think we both came to this realization where we were like, well, we could do this instead.
Yeah.
So we kept, you know, we jobs for as long as it made sense, and we knew that eventually the way things were going, those paths would diverge. Mm-hmm. And once diverge, we would choose this, because we were both, you know, just really hungry to have something that was ours, where there were no rules or restrictions on what you can do and what you can say and what you can create.
Yeah, that's a kind of a scary thing to go into, though, isn't it? I mean, especially for, you know, being in Panic at the Disco for the better part of a decade, like you said, Ryan's old band doing very well. And all of a sudden, I mean, you say you've got two kids. You know, you're not like a 25-year-old kid living in your parents' mm-hmm. basement. Oh, figure something yeah. else out. This is real life.
Yeah, it's very scary to because, you know, if you're a musician, then to be able to have a steady paycheck, like you've crossed the finish line, you've won.
Yeah,
you know, that's the goal of anyone who wants to play music for a living, is even if it's not to be, you know, some rich famous rock star, to be able to keep your bills paid by playing music, like that's the dream. And I had accomplished that, so to walk away from that and head off into the unknown with this thing that was showing promise but has no guarantees was definitely, you know, a little bit daunting, but ultimately worth it.
For sure.
Because I would much rather, you know, I thought about it for a while. I would much rather play to playing a room full of 200 people that really cared about, you know, what it was that we were creating, rather than be an anonymous musician on a stage full of 20,000 people playing yeah. someone else's music.
Well, that's funny, though. That kind of has come full circle, right? And I was going to ask mm-hmm. you that question earlier, but I didn't want to be, like, offensive to say, you know, you go from the Brobecks, where it's, like, your thing, it's your band, you're the front man, to playing in front of 20,000 people with Panic, you know, opening for another band where you're just mm-hmm. kind of another guy. I mean, yeah. some people's ego, they don't like that. It's just it's not the right thing when it's not their thing anymore, no matter how big it is.
And that's another thing, is that everything that I've done musically has always been born out of necessity. So even when it comes to things like being a frontman, it's not something that's ever been on my bucket list or right. my goal. It's just been the only way that I've ever been able to make my songs happen is by doing them myself. So that was the case with the Brobecks, and that's the case with this band too. It's not that, oh my God, I have to be a lead singer, I have to be in the spotlight. I've never had that desire or that drive. It's more that I have these songs that I want to create, and it seems like, historically at least, the only way that I've ever been able to make them is by doing it myself.
No, and it's amazing, this being a show about lead singers, how many people really never set out to be a lead singer. That's what yeah. they're known for. I'd say yeah. 80 to 90% of people probably are like, I don't know, I'm a drummer or whatever. I just mm-hmm. just know I was the only guy in the room that could carry a tune. You know, that yeah. that's talked about all the time. So here we go. Here's another example of it. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. dude, so I mean, I assume, you know, this pandemic hit. It sounds like the record was already recorded. I don't know where you were in the middle of March when everything went south, but walk me through the steps of how this record came to be, when you decided, hey, we've got to postpone it, and just kind of where, you know, where you were at in your life when this all happened?
Yeah, so we had the majority of the record written when we released our first EP. But like I said, Fearless Records came in and said, we want to put you on tour for a while and capitalize on this heat that you guys have for a while. So we did that, put to recording the rest of the album on hold. So everything that was on the EP was meant to be part of this record. It was all always meant to be one thing, but that time in between allowed us to write a couple more songs too. So, you know, it probably wouldn't have ended up being exactly the same had we done it as originally planned. But we finally got the chance to go record the thing in February.
Okay.
And that's when COVID started to show up in the news.
Yep.
And by the time we had wrapped recording, it was late February, early March. So that's when things like lockdowns and stuff started to happen. So I flew home and we had to mix the record via email, which not ideal.
No.
So that ended up taking a long time. I think every song had more than a dozen emails, you know, trying to dial in this stuff. So that took a long time. That was a major delay.
Yeah.
And then it was a matter of sort of navigating this new idea of lockdowns and not being able to tour and everyone grabbing at straws. How do you release an album in this climate? How do you promote it? But luckily, we had a team that was really stoked on the record that we had made and didn't want to hesitate. So we all felt like it had been delayed enough from the time that we had been touring on off of the EP. So
for sure,
we just decided to give it the green light despite everything that's going on. And oddly enough, it's been great to be able to put a record out and to, as much as we want to be out there playing shows, like to be able to be at home with my family and promote this record, like has been something I've never experienced before. But I'm really grateful to, you know, that's been sort of the silver lining in all of it for me.
No, I imagine this has been the longest you've probably been home in your adult life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So is that an amazing feeling? Is it harder than you expected?
Well, everyone has those hard days. I think the stress and the paranoia that surrounds COVID and everything, it sort of builds up from time to time. So every once in a while you have that day where the rain clouds sort of hanging over your head everywhere you go. And that's the day when my wife is like, go down to your studio and work for a while or something, like get out of here.
No, that makes sense. Well, I want to talk about the record a little bit more. I know you worked with Tim Pagnotta, who from Sugar Cult, a band, very, very much a Warped Tour band at one point. You know, what kind of blew my mind about this record? Well, there's a couple things, but the production for sure. I mean, some of the sounds that you managed to find, I'm not talking about bass tones or drum tones either. You know, some of the other instrumentation, they managed to sound original, but also classic. Yeah. And that's not easy to do. And I kind of wonder, how does that work? Does that something that, you know, you're doing in your basement studio and you're kind of saying, hey, Tim, this is kind of what I want. And he kind of dials it in, or is it back and forth? Or,
well, Tim was really great about letting us experiment and get weird with sounds.
Yeah.
So, and another thing that I think helped us dial that in was we created a set of rules for ourselves before we started making the record. And these were rules that, for all intents and purposes, we knew that we would break them at some point. But rules were like, okay, we're going to limit ourselves to three specific keyboards. And any of the synth sounds that happen on this record are going to come from only the synthesizers. And another rule that we had was no guitars. So we went for as long as we could making this record, following those rules, knowing that eventually we would break them because, like, we're not adverse to guitar. It's definitely, you know, a tool that comes in handy sonically. So but we wanted to treat it more like a supportive instrument rather than have it be front and center. A good example would be a record like Elvis Costello's This Year's Model, which is one of my favorite records ever. And the way that guitar is treated on that record is more like a supporting role. Right. Like the keyboards and the bass are the ones that do all of the heavy lifting when it comes to melody.
Right.
So we wanted to treat guitar that way. And a lot of the synthesis stuff came from these vintage keyboards that we had. Two of them belonged to me and one of them belonged to Tim. And yeah, the vast majority of synthesizer sounds came from vintage equipment. And then we did a lot of experimentation with tape machines and tape loops and things like that too. So I think it all came together pretty nicely. Helped it to have a kind of a vintage feel to it.
Absolutely, yeah. And the other note I have here is just how you guys can seemingly exist in so many different musical spaces while still having a cohesive sound. And the reference that I'm pulling from mostly is the From the Gallows, I believe the song is called. And it's it almost sounds like if the 50s were in the future. If that makes any sense.
No, yeah. The original demo for that song was based off of the Ink Spots, which is this old jazz group that I love from the 1930s. They had this really great formula for writing songs. If you look them up, you'll notice that they follow this pattern with every song that they wrote. It's one of those groups that people are familiar with without really knowing it.
Right, right.
You know, I don't want to set the world on fire, like that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So it was based on that stuff, and that was the original demo, like barbershop quartet harmonies, I should say, yep. And things like that. But when we went into the studio, we sort of disassembled it and put it back together, and it ended up sounding like Lawrence Welk on acid, and I really loved how it turned out.
Absolutely. And I mean, so many bright spots. We could probably talk about almost every track on this record, but Leave Me Alone, obviously track number one, it's kind of been a smash hit. I mean, it's a great song, a great choice for the first single, but I kind of wonder how that choice was made. It must not have been easy. With all the songs to say, okay, this is the one we're going to kind of come out of the gate with.
I think everyone just kind of gravitated towards Leave Me Alone as the process went on. You know, that's one of those songs that almost felt like it wrote itself.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mostly did it at my kitchen table before we went into the studio with Tim. So by the time I think we went into to lay it down, it was 90% done, but we put it off and kept working on the record. But I don't know. It felt like an easy decision as far as everybody on the team. Like, okay, this is the one that we want to go to radio.
Right, and the video. Can we talk about the video? Was that pre COVID?
Like it was post COVID.
It was post COVID. Okay.
Again, it's a matter of, you know, things being done out of necessity. We found ourselves in this weird moment of having to promote a single on a record. You know, how do you make a music video but keep everybody safe in the middle of this pandemic? So that's where the idea started to formulate of incorporating things like masks and quarantine and social distancing and all this plastic sheeting and, you know, sterile environments. And it was definitely a reflection of the time that we're living in.
Yeah. Yeah. And what a time. What a time to be alive, man. I guess you guys probably had shows postponed. What's going on there? Like, what does the future hold for you guys? I mean, do you have any plans? Have you been doing any live streams or anything like that?
Yeah, we've been doing live streams, and we recorded a few different sessions with a full lineup of live musicians at a studio here in Utah. Some really talented people that live around here. A guy named Robbie Connolly, who plays with The Killers.
Yeah,
and then another really talented guy named Stu Maxfield, who did a co-write on the record with me, co-wrote Sugar Pills. We got those guys together into a studio, and we played all this stuff live over 3 or 4 days. And I think a lot of that footage is still waiting to be seen. Like, it's being doled out bit by bit. So, you know, for this outlet or for that radio station or whatever it is.
Right.
But we're going to do more stuff like that. And, you know, any time that an opportunity arises to play a show, we sign up for it and we want to take it. And that's happened a couple times. But as we've gotten closer to actually making these dates happen, they get shut down because of new restrictions or whatever. And that's fine because we don't want to play if it comes at the expense of anybody's health or,
right.
Safety is the most important thing. So,
right. No, we did, my band did a drive-in show, and that was pretty awesome. I'm surprised there aren't more of those happening. I feel like, obviously it's cold up here in the north, but I feel like they could be doing those, and that would be something everybody could enjoy. I'm surprised they're not happening more.
Yeah, it's something that we're definitely keeping an eye out for. And early on, there was some talk of doing a social show at a soccer stadium here in Salt Lake City.
Oh, yeah.
But the governor came out with some new COVID restrictions, and that ended up being shut down. So it's kind of like we make these plans, and we hope for the best, but just prepare for them not to happen, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it's been this whole year, man. Well, anything else to tell the people? I don't think I have too much else to ask you. Just really enjoyed the latest record. Thanks for putting it out.
No, I appreciate you having me, and I appreciate the support that we've been shown over the course of doing this little rock band. And I really appreciate you having us on.
Absolutely, Dallin. And I'm going to play a new track from the record. Do you mind picking it? Which one would you like me to play?
Oh boy, go ahead and play From the Gallows.
That's perfect.
That's probably the weirdest track on the record, and if you can get behind that one, then I think you've passed the I don't know how test.
I love it. No, the instrumentation on this one is incredible. I really enjoyed it. So,
right, dude, thanks, man.
Hey man, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely appreciate it. Right, thank you.
Here it is, From the Gallows on Lead Singer Syndrome.
You're beautiful and evil too, sinister and vile. For you, I'd die or kill myself, whichever makes you smile. And if I succeed, I'll count all your teeth. I swim from the gallows and wail, and death from the noose, lest you cut me loose. I carousel into my grave.
Darling, Lord knows you're beautiful, but you're evil. Fact is, you're downright vicious too. But each night I look up at the stars in the sky, and I can't help it, but I still wish I was with you.
And if I succeed, I'll count up.
There is From the Gallows, from I Don't Know How's new album, Razzmatazz, which is a very cool album. We talk about the production and, you know, we touch on some of those things in this episode, of course, but I think it's understated a little bit just how cool this record is. And I feel like this is the kind of thing you could put on at Christmas time, you know, around the holidays with the family, and they might be into it, you know? You can get away with putting it on. It isn't, there's no screaming to be found, that's for sure. Next week, I will be back with another great episode. Soupy, Mr. Dan Campbell of the Wonder Years will be on the show. A long-awaited return. I think he was episode number 2. So he's going to go from episode number 2 to episode 254, which is amazing. But the Wonder Years, they're doing lots of cool stuff. Some stuff just announced. So don't miss it. Make sure that you smash the subscribe button on whatever you're listening to. Check out the All Access Club. And that's about it. Peace and love, everybody. I'll see you next week. And maybe on Twitch. Follow us on Twitch. Twitch.tv/ShaneTold.